We're getting ready to write the position representation of the time evolution operator for a particle moving in one dimension. And we'd realized that you generally could write these time evolution operators as sums over paths, sums of amplitudes over paths to go from the initial state to the final state, and we're going to do that for the position representation of the time evolution operator. And we at the very conclusion of our business last time, talked about two handy pieces of mathematics that we're going to make use of today. One is, and I've written them in the opposite order that we talked about them last time. One of them is that if you have an operator exponential, the exponential of the sum of two operators, then in general, if those operators don't commute, you don't get the product of the exponentials of those operators. In general, you don't get that. You get something much more complicated, and the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula sort of gives you a clue about that. But if the operators are multiplied by a small parameter, then to first order in that parameter, you do get the product of these things. And so if epsilon is small enough that we can somehow argue we can ignore terms of order epsilon squared and higher, then this equality does hold well enough. And the second thing was about Gaussian integrals. And we'd worked out this particular Gaussian integral, which we'll find to be handy a little bit later on. Okay, so let's get underway. What we're going to do, here we go. What we're going to do is we're going to calculate what's called the propagator. And even though it probably ought to be designated by a kernel letter U, since it's all about a unitary operator, we're not going to do that. We're going to designate it by a K, because that's traditional. And theoretical physicists were just hidebound by tradition. So we'll write it this way. Here we've got some initial position at an initial time, and here we have a final position at a final time, and this thing will give me an amplitude for going from this position at this time to this position at that time. And so what I might I'll write that as final position unitary operator of TFTI X initial. That's what we mean by this. So this is the position representation, the position matrix elements for this time evolution operator. And so what does this function do? Well, if for a fixed time interval, if you give it an initial position and a final position, this function gives you a complex number. This is just a complex number. It's not an operator. It's a matrix element. And that complex number is, as we saw, the probability amplitude that a particle starting out here will at the later time be found to be here. The probability amplitude for that. And then, of course, if you have not simply a definite initial position, but you have some superposition of positions, then you have to sum up over a bunch of amplitudes for initial positions. But this is how it works. Okay, now we're going to be considering uniform dynamics. And so we're not going to really be considering the initial time. That doesn't really matter. All we need is the elapsed time from t initial to t final. So we're going to be looking at some u of t. And of course, we're going to therefore be computing k KXFT XI0. And that's just, as we said, something like so. Now, we're going to do the trick we did last time. We're going to take this time interval, and we're going to chop it up into very many, very short time intervals. So we're going to write this as a product of a whole bunch of terms like u delta, just what we did last time. And delta is equal to t over n. And so there are n of these. There are n of these terms. And so what does that give us? Well, here we go. We got the k of xft xi 0. What are we going to do? Boy, that piece of chalk is full of faults. What are we going to do? Well, we're going to introduce between every term or every factor in this product of u's, we're going to introduce the position basis using the completeness relation for position, which you'll recall, I'll write it over here as things will recall, that completeness relation is that if I integrate over all positions of this expression here, that gives me the identity. So I'll introduce that a whole bunch of times, and what will I get? Well, let's see. I'll get a bunch of integrals over position. I'll get an integral over what I'll call dx1, and an integral over dx2, all the way up to an integral over d sub x. Well, how many such bases will I introduce here? N minus 1, correct? N minus 1 of them. And then that will be the integral of things like this. There'll be xf u of delta. And let's write these so that 1 through n minus 1, and that's not to the n minus 1, it's sub n minus 1, of course. Let's do it so that these things appear in time order. First comes 1, next comes. So this one's the last of them. X to the n minus, why do I put it to the power? Oh, I know why. Yeah, OK. Something I was worrying about. X1 u delta xi. There we go. So here we've got it. We've got just what we want. We've got a sum over paths. The sequence of intermediate points that the particle is imagined to pass through, this sequence of intermediate points amounts to a sum over paths. And this is a complex number. That's the amplitude for that path. Well, how does that work out? Well, what we want to do is we want to figure out what one of these is, so we can sort of see how this sum works out. Okay, what's one of these? So let's take the kth interval. And that is to say the one that goes from x sub k to x sub k plus 1. And I can think of xi as x0 and xf as xn if I wish to do that. So the kth interval goes from xk to xk plus 1 a little bit later. And so let's take a look at this business right here. We have xk plus 1 here. We have u delta. And we have xk. Well, what's that equal to? What's that equal to? Let's remember what our Hamiltonian is. What's the Hamiltonian for the particle moving in one dimension? Right, there's p squared over 2m plus some potential. Right, some potential. So we're going to have x sub k plus 1 of e to the minus i P squared over 2 mu plus V of x delta over h bar xk. Now, this is the sum of two non-commuting parts. So we say, oh, too bad we can't just split it up into product of exponentials. They don't commute. On the other hand, they're multiplied by delta. And delta is a small parameter. Delta is small. We're going to take n to be very large so that delta is small. Small enough so that to the approximation that we'll need in this integral, to the approximation we'll need, and in the limit exactly, this can be written as a product of the two separate parts. So I'm beginning to understand what's going on here. I'm writing long expressions today instead of short ones, and so I need bigger columns. Where we work across the board. Managed to get four columns across the board last time. Not going to work today. So, maybe turn your paper sideways and get ready for what's coming. So what we find is that xk plus 1 u delta xk, I can write, it's perfectly okay to write, xk plus 1 e to the minus I p squared delta over 2 mu h bar e to the minus I v of x delta over h bar xk. That's okay. It's okay to write that to the order that we're going to need to work in. If there are additional terms, then in the limit those terms will go away. This is kind of neat because this operator is a function of the x operator only, and this is an eigenstate of that operator. So we can actually evaluate this operator action in a very easy way. I just get a complex number out of it. So this is just, x sub k plus 1 e to the minus I p squared delta over 2 mu h bar xk times e to the minus I v of xk delta over h bar. I've actually done that because I had an eigenstate of position there. Too bad that I don't have an eigenstate of momentum. Because then I'd be able to do this guy. Wouldn't it be nice if I had an eigenstate of momentum so that since this operator is a function of momentum, I could then evaluate it. But of course, if I don't have an eigenstate of momentum, I can always put one in. I can always put one in by using the momentum completeness relation, which is this. So by introducing a momentum variable into the kth interval, I can do the same trick again. So let me put that identity right here and just show you what this is going to be like. I'm going to have the integral over d p sub k. P sub k is a momentum that's going to be, I'm going to do this for all the different intervals. Okay, all the different intervals. So this is the momentum associated with the kth interval. And I'm going to have xk plus 1 p sub k e to the minus I p squared delta over 2 mu h bar xk all times e to the minus I v of xk delta over h bar. Okay? So that's the expression that I get when I introduce this momentum basis into the kth interval. And now it's easy because this guy acting on this way, I can think of this as the dagger of the conjugate of something acting the other way. Because this is now an eigenstate of momentum, then I'll just get a complex number out of this. And so I get the integral dpk of x sub k plus 1 pk x sub k all times e to the minus I p sub k squared over 2 mu plus v of xk times delta divided by h bar. There we go. So what about this? What about these guys? Well, of course, what this guy would be is the wave function for the pk momentum eigenstate. The wave function in the x basis that's the k plus first x basis. Okay, and similarly for that. That is to say, I want to remind you that xp. Well, what is that? Well, it's 1 over the square root of 2 pi h bar times e to the I px over h bar. Yeah?
Why can't you just take out your integral of dpk, the whole complete set of states again?
Why can't you take out the integral?
Well, I mean, it's just the identity, right?
But I'm multiplying them by a phase factor that depends on pk.
Okay.
So it's not the identity. Yeah. It'd be nice, but unfortunately, pk appears here. Yeah?
When you add that e to the minus I of p squared delta to the left, don't you have to take its dagger? So didn't that minus I come off the plus?
Very good. Let's imagine what I'm doing. So the idea is I'm looking at something like this. P sub k, e to the minus I, p squared, delta over 2 mu h bar, right? And I want to see what that is. But that is equal to, quite right, the dagger of e to the I p squared delta over 2 mu h bar, acting on pk, dagger, that's what that is, right? So now I go ahead and do that, and I get e to the I p, as you said, e to the I p k squared delta over 2 mu h bar p k dagger, but when I take the complex, when I take the conjugate, this becomes complex conjugated again, and so the minus sign reappears. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so we can actually write this out in a nice way. We're going to get. We sort of see how it works. This is the dagger thing again.
What's the second line? Because isn't it the same as this one?
This is equal to that.
And the second and third line aren't they the same?
No, because this is p sub k. This is now an eigenstate of the p operator. These p's are p operators. The p sub k is a particular value of p associated with this momentum eigenstate.
Yeah?
And so the difference between this and this is that since this is an eigenstate of this operator, then this is just the eigenvalue for that eigenstate. And then when I... And to complete this, I get pk e to the minus I pk. So if I have to complex conjugate this complex number. And I can, of course, multiply either side. Okay, other questions about that? So good questions. Can't be too careful with this non-commuting stuff. Okay, so... All right, so this tells us that xk plus 1 u delta xk is equal to, well, let's see, I've got two of these guys. two of these inner products of this form. So I'm going to get two factors of 1 over the square root of 2 mu h bar. So I'm going to get 2 pi h bar, 1 over 2 pi h bar. I'm going to get an integral over dpk. And then I'm going to get these exponential factors from this and from this. But notice that this one, the one pkxk, that inner product will give me something like this complex conjugated, which will give me a minus sign in the exponential. And so let's just write down what those are. Everything will be an exponential. Let's just write down what that exponential is. So for the first guy, for these guys, I'm going to have I times, let's see, there's going to be a pk for both of them, and there's going to be an xk plus 1 minus xk over h bar. And then I'm going to get these terms from this exponential, and that's going to be minus I times pk squared over 2 mu plus v of xk times delta over h bar. And there we go. OK, now this is cool. It's cool in a lot of ways. But you can see what's really neat about it. You can see this right here. This xk plus 1 minus xk. In order to combine these terms together, it would be really nice if I wrote this as something times delta. I've already got it as something over h bar, something times delta. But if I took xk plus 1 minus xk and divided that by delta, I'd get a kind of a derivative. How fast is the particle moving going from xk to xk plus 1 a time delta later, right? This can be thought of as, so xk plus 1 minus xk over delta can be thought of as xk dot. It's the speed over the kth interval. It's the particle velocity over the kth interval along this path. Okay? Velocity during the kth interval. Of course, it's an average velocity, but we always define instantaneous velocity as a limit of average velocities, and so in the limit, this is going to be the velocity of that. And so if I have that, then I get to write it this way: 1 over 2 pi h bar, the integral of dpk of the exponential of I times a whole bunch of stuff. And it's really cool. I've got pk xk dot minus pk squared over 2 mu minus that plus this. Let's write it this way. All of that, okay, yes, okay, times delta over h bar. Okay, sorry about the too many parentheses, but that's the result that I get. It's kind of neat. It's kind of neat. You recognize that the something like the Hamiltonian appears there, but there's this extra thing. What the extra thing comes from is the fact that there's a little bit of a difference between pk in this representation and pk in that representation. Well, okay. All right. So where am I in my notes? You know, I should look down from time to time, touch the ground. Okay, this is an interesting expression. There's one of these for each interval. So what's the whole thing? What's the whole thing? So let's take a look at what the whole a propagator is. The whole propagator is. Okay. Well, let's see. First of all, there are going to be how many such integrals? Actually, there are going to be n of them. Because there's one for every term here. There's going to be n of these dpk integrals because there's one of those, not for each point between the time the subintervals, but one for each interval. Okay, so that's interesting. So I'll write it this. There'll be a 1 over 2 pi h bar to the nth power. There'll be integrals. Those integrals, you're right, there are n minus 1 of those. But for the p integrals, there are n of those. And I'm identifying the interval by the guy at the front end of the interval. And so this is going to be an integral of dp 0 all the way up to dp n minus 1. And then an exponential, and it's this exponential here, exponential of I, it's going to be the product of a whole bunch of terms like this. But the things in the exponent, in this exponential, are not operators or anything. They're just scalars. They're just numbers. And so I can use the usual exponential rule. The product of a bunch of exponentials is the exponential of the sum. I get the sum over k, k is ranging from 0 to n minus 1, of pk xk dot minus pk squared over 2 mu, minus v of xk, all of that times delta divided by h bar. There it is. And notice what this is like. Let's, I can write this in a cool way. Let's take this, look at what this guy is. What this guy is. This guy says, take all the possible intermediate positions of the particle. Furthermore, for every time interval, every subinterval, take all the possible momenta of the particle in that. In other words, find all the possible trajectories from one point to the other in phase space. All the possible phase space trajectories. And sum up over all of those guys. And what's this guy right here? Well, look. I'll write this out. Here's a fancy that's not right. There we go. A fancy way to write integrate over all the possible intermediate momenta and all the possible intermediate paths. I'm not going to do much with this, so I'm not taking this very seriously. That's everything that I've indicated by this pink line is here. This is a kind of normalization, and then here I get in the limit. So this is a limit as the number of subintervals goes to infinity. I get the exponential of I times the integral from 0 to t of p x dot minus the Hamiltonian, which is a function of p and x, over h bar. This multiplying each one of these guys by delta means that as n goes to infinity, this sum becomes the integral. And so look at this. This is kind of interesting. This says integrate over all possible paths in which I start at x initial and wind up at x final, all possible trajectories, and integrate not just over all possible trajectories in configuration space, but all possible paths in momentum space as well. And the momentum is not tied to the configuration. The momentum is not mv here. It's not mx dot. It's the momentum's allowed to freely wobble around. You take all the possible ways of going from one to the other in phase space, and you add up the exponential of a phase. What's that phase? Well, look at this integral right here. This integral, and sorry, that should have a dt in it. A d tall, let's say. Look at that integral right there. That integral is over some variable. Look at this integral right here. This is one form of the classical action. This is the phase space form of the classical action for a path in phase space, which you may remember. This is not where I'm headed, but it's kind of cool looking, and you should see it, and sometimes it's useful. Okay, where am I headed? Well, where I'm headed is the fact that you all really noticed by now. And that is that that if I go back to this integral, you'll notice that I should be able to actually do that integral. Exactly. Wow. I never actually heard that happen before. You should be able to do that integral, because this is a Gaussian integral in PK. It's got a linear term. It's got a quadratic term. Indeed, in this integral, and let me hang on to this guy. In this integral, I have playing the role of my little Gaussian integral reminder here, if you will, playing the role of alpha. Playing the role of alpha is I times delta over 2 mu h bar. That's the thing that plays the role of alpha in this expression. Playing the role of beta. Let's see. Is the coefficient of just p sub k, the linear coefficient. And it's I x dot of k delta over h bar. And so I'll be able to write down what this integral is explicitly. So let's do that. Xk u of delta, xk plus 1 in front, xk. Having done the momentum integral, what will I get? Well, let's see. I'll get a factor of the square root of pi over this, which is going to involve the square root of 2 mu h bar. And that'll multiply by this 1 over 2 mu h bar. And so the overall factor that I get out front is, so just the mu is left. There's a mu over 2 pi h bar. There's an I, there's a delta. That's all to the 1 half power. And there's an exponential of what? Well, when I do the integral, I have a term which is beta exponential of beta squared, and so that beta squared is going to give me a term that's going to be x dot squared. Of course, I'll have to divide it by 4 times alpha, and all kinds of things cancel. And let me just write what the result is. It's beautiful. And then the v of x is not involved in the integral. V of xk is not involved in the integral. And this is all times delta divided by h bar. Right, here we go. And that means that the propagator is mu over 2 pi h bar I delta, and there are going to be a bunch of these guys. How many of these guys are to the 1/2? A 1/2 here. How many of these guys are there going to be? Well, there's going to be one of those for every interval. Not for every intermediate point, but one of these for every interval. One of these for every time interval. So I get actually n over 2. In your homework, I have an n minus 1 here. I have a minus 1, which is wrong. But actually, hardly matters. Okay? So there's going to be a factor of n here. All right? And then there's going to be integrals over all the intermediate positions. I haven't done those guys. And then there's going to be an exponential of I times the sum over all the intervals here, the sum of mu over 2 xk dot squared minus v of xk times delta over h bar. Okay. Now, this guy right here doesn't depend on the path. This guy right here doesn't depend on the potential. So I can take this guy, so different problems where I have problem with the particles moving in different potentials won't have this to be any different. So this guy I'm going to regard as part of the normalization of the integral over the paths. Part of the normalization of the integral over the paths. So it's sort of part of that sum. So as n goes to infinity, then I'm going to take mu over 2 pi h bar I delta to the n over 2. That times all these integrals of intermediate points. That's going to just go to what I'm going to call the integral over the path. The integral over the path, where x represents some path that goes between the initial and the final. Okay? To do this path integral, I'm going to say, well, in order to do it right, to normalize it correctly, I have some choice about that because an integral over all paths, well, there's convergence questions and normalization questions. We're just going to absorb this normalization factor into that. And as n goes to infinity, this exponential, I mean, look at what's in here. This is kinetic energy minus potential energy. What's kinetic energy minus potential energy? The Lagrangian. This is the Lagrangian. What we're going to have is that this exponential that we have here, blah, 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 goes to an exponential of, as n goes to infinity, an integral, I times the integral from 0 to t of 1/2 or mu over 2 x dot squared minus v of x d tau over h bar. But that is simply the classical action. So let's think about that. This is as close to magic as you will ever see. In this class. So what we've got is we've got a path x of tau. We've got paths x of tau. X of 0 is our initial guy, and x of t is our final guy. But in between, it can wiggle all around. And we have the action. The action s. The action s is, I'll write it this way, this is a functional of that path. If you give me a path, I can compute a number, which is the action. It's a functional of the path. And it's the integral from 0 to t of the Lagrangian of x and x dot. And for fastidiousness? Anyway, for completeness sake, I'll write tau here, except that I have specifically assumed in my derivation that it didn't depend on time. So. This is the integral of Lagrangian. It's a functional of the path, and my final result is that the propagator 0, the propagator is nothing but the properly normalized integral over all the paths of e to the I. Action of the path divided by h bar. And so this is something I'll draw a box around. I'll draw two boxes around it. There should be beams of golden light emitted from the chalkboard at this point. This is the path integral expression. The path integral expression, because I'm integrating over all possible paths, the path integral expression for the propagator. Now, there are all kinds of things to note about this. One is that the Lagrangian plays a direct role in the quantum mechanical time evolution. You don't just take the Lagrangian is not just a halfway house on the way to deriving the Hamiltonian, and then you can write down the Schrodinger equation. It appears directly. Furthermore, these things are all functionals, but everything here is in terms of numbers. There are no operators here. This you can think of as the matrix elements of a time evolution operator. But that just really means it's a complex number. Okay, everything you see here are kind of number, numerical. Now. Operators are sort of buried in here. Commutation relations are buried in here. That's the point of the homework problem. This is sort of all written in terms of numerical kinds of quantities. Finally, you can see that it's exactly the kind of expression we had before, the sum over paths of an amplitude for the path. But here's the amazing thing. When we talked about things like a quantum computer or something, the different computational paths contributed amplitudes, but those amplitudes weren't all the same modulus. They weren't all the same size. Some of the amplitudes might have been zero. A lot of them might have been zero. But there were some which were non-zero, and they interfered with each other. Here, all of the paths contribute amplitudes of the same size. They differ only in phase. It's a total democracy. Okay? No amplitude gets a bigger vote than any other individually. That's shocking. The path, which path you're talking about, only affects the phase. Now, if you have an electron going from here to here, there's a path that sort of goes in a straight line that contributes an amplitude to this sum over paths. There's also a path that goes zooming off and orbits Jupiter a couple of times and comes back to here. And that path gets an amplitude of the same modulus. Okay? Now, somehow, we have this idea that that amplitude maybe isn't as important. Okay? Because as a practical matter, when we calculate how the electron goes from here to here, we don't really believe we have to take into account the conditions in the vicinity of Jupiter. Okay? Now, partly, that intuition springs from classical mechanics. Say, oh yeah, well, when a particle goes from here to here, it follows a trajectory. It only samples a little bit of the universe. It doesn't, you know, doesn't do this. Quantum mechanically, though, looks like it samples everywhere. How do we understand this? And the answer is quite beautiful. Feynman pointed this out. And the answer is, in fact, where classical mechanics comes from. Yep, okay. So let's remember what the classical path is. X classical, which is, of course, a function of time. Which path is the classical path in terms of the action? Yeah, it's the least action, right? It's the path that it minimizes the action. The classical path is the path of least action. That's the famous Hamilton's principle. Which means that that the action changes. The change in the action is zero to first order, that is to say, for small variations from xc. That is to say, xc going to xc plus some little delta x that vanishes at the endpoint. So if I consider a nearby path, they have almost the same action. It's analogous to the minimum of a function being the place where if you move a little bit to the right or to the left, it's essentially flat at the bottom. So, so let's consider a so this is time, and here's x. Let's consider a couple of points. Here's x initial, and here's x final. Later on at t, let's consider the classical path. This is the classical path. Well, this says that if you consider paths that are close to this, all of these paths that are close to the classical path, all have about the same classical action. So these paths have about the same action, and that means that the phases e to the I action over h bar. These phases will be about the same. And so when I add up all over all the paths, these guys will be a bunch of complex numbers with about the same phase. And so they'll add up to something big. These will constructively interfere. Why? Because a small change in path produces a small change in the action. In fact, a first-order change in the path produces no first-order change in the action near the classical trajectory. But consider another trajectory down here. Consider some other trajectories that are far from the classical path. Then they don't have this paths around that path don't have this special property that that small variations give about the same that small variations give the same action to first order. Now, if I consider a another path that's kind of like this guy, but a little bit different, okay, then those guys will have quite different actions, because this is nowhere close to the minimum of an of the action. Nowhere close to the minimum of the action. So these paths down here have very different S. Not just different from this, though it is very different from this, but different from each other. A first order change in the path will produce a first order change in the action. And so that means that these paths for this widely varying phase, the phases e to the I s over h bar for these guys will be very different complex numbers. The argument here will be very different. And when I add them up, they'll tend to cancel each other out, because the actions will be very different for these different nearby paths. So these tend to destructively interfere. They don't contribute much to the sum. So if I think about the electron going from this point to that point, and I think about the paths that go out and orbit Jupiter, another path that goes out and orbits Jupiter almost in exactly the same way will produce a very different action. And so although an individual path gets the same vote as a simple straight line path, in the aggregate, those guys tend to cancel each other out, but the ones close to the classical action tend to reinforce each other. Yeah?
Is there any other path where S could be equal to zero? Like, could there be more than one minimum?
Yeah, we're about to get to that. And indeed, nothing here really says that S has to be minimized, does it? The key thing is simply that around the classical trajectory, this is true. And in fact, you can come up with classical situations where the classical trajectory is actually, the solution of the equation of motion is actually a maximum action path. Or it's minimum to some kinds of variations and maximum to other kinds of variations. You can have that. You still get the classical equation of motion, not by actually minimizing this, but by this. This is where the classical equation of the motion comes from. So really, it's not the principle of minimum action, it's the principle of stationary action. Furthermore, it might be that there are a couple of different paths which could do this, and you would expect each bundle of paths like that to make a big contribution. And you'd have to consider both. Yeah?
Is the double slit experiment an example of that?
No, not really. And the reason is that it is. All right, so when I say that these paths have very different S, an important point here is that
draw the conclusion I want to draw and then answer your question. Okay, so what this says is only paths with S. X near the classical action make a strong contribution, a strong net contribution. And near means that S of X minus S of X classical, that divided by H bar, because it's divided by H bar in the phase, divided by H bar is not too big. It's not very much greater than 1. Now, if you have a very small particle, okay, if you have a very small particle or something, then the action over the action might be for lots of paths might be really small compared to H bar, and what happens in the two slit experiment is typically you arrange it so that there's a lot of diffraction from the slits, that they spread out a lot, and what that effectively means is that the total action going from the source to the detector is small enough that what looked like macroscopic variations in the path don't change the action very much. That's why it's relatively easy to do an interference experiment with, well, it's one reason, one of many reasons why it's very easy, more easy to do an interference experiment with a little tiny particle like an electron, much harder to do it with a much larger particle because the actions involved are much larger for the mass. That's where that affects. The classical trajectory, the two-slit experiment is usually set up so the classical trajectory is not very strongly picked. So the classical trajectories are not very strongly picked out. But the general point is good. If there were a couple of classical paths, a couple of possible classical paths that start here and wind up there, like in an oscillator, that could happen, for example. It started here, you wound up here one period later, well, you might have gone like this, or you might have gone like that. All these guys minimize the action. Then all of those guys will make important contributions. Yeah?
How do we know that paths far from, that those paths at the bottom of the graph will have very different actions?
Well, how do we know the ones at the bottom of the graph? Oh, I see. Well, what does this mean? This means that that the variation in S, the difference between one path and the other up here, is not first order in the variation of the path. Okay, it's not first order in the variation of the path. So I can make quite a lot of wiggles, just as I can move quite a long way around at the bottom of my parabola. I can move back and forth quite a bit. Exactly how much depends on how curvy the parabola is, but I can move back and forth quite a bit and won't change the value of the function. But if I shift to a point on the slope of the parabola and I move back and forth a bit, then a first order change in the path, or a first order change to the point there, will produce a first order change in the value of the function. What I'm saying is that comparable sized changes in the paths down here will produce much larger changes in S than here, because here it's close to it's around the it's around this. So to first order, there's no change in this, but to first order, there's a big change. So it's a change of a different order. Here the changes are of order delta x squared. Here the changes are of order delta x. If delta x is small, these are much bigger than that. Yeah.
Some paths are going to have the particle moving faster than the speed of light.
Oh well, I've been doing a non-relativistic calculation, so I haven't taken that into account at all. My expression for the but suppose I tried to do that. Let's see. But there's an intermediate kind of calculation that I just don't know very well, because it doesn't lead you to much, and that is to do relativistic particle mechanics this way. The place this goes is to a field theory. Okay, is to talk about field theory, because fields are easy to talk about in terms of a Lagrangian, okay? The particles are simply quantized excitations of the field. So I don't know. I honestly don't know what the right thing to do is if you want to just sort of add a, have a relativistic particle. That's not how you would do relativistic particle mechanics, because at relativistic speeds you have to take into account the fact that you can create and annihilate particles and things like that. So that they are antiparticles. That all comes out of the field theory. That's a terribly insufficient answer, but that's what I can tell you. In non-relativistic theory, the speed of light plays no role. So yeah, sure, the faster the light. That would be one of the things you'd add up. But of course, the Hamiltonian I wrote down is not ignored the relativistic effects.
If you set up your system so that instead of going from point x1 at time 1 to point 2 at time 2, and you put time and space in the same footing so that you take jumps in space-time rather than across time, I don't really know how to word my question.
Oh, I see. Oh, so you're thinking of this as adding up world lines, or mm-hmm. looking at world lines between the two points, and the question is,
would that get rid of the problem? Like, would you then bound which paths you can have, or can you still move off shell?
Of course you can move off shell. Yes, the shell emerges. From the action, the being on the mass shell is not a constraint. It's a result of the dynamics. So yeah, you can move off shell. Although the paths that are very much off shell, if they're big paths with big actions compared to H bar. The paths that are very far off shell will almost all destructively interfere with each other, and only paths that are very close to being on shell will contribute. Yeah.
Normalization effect on all that interval, we have one over delta, and we are taking the limit of delta equals to zero. What that creates the problem?
Oh yeah. Well, see, there's a lot of things like that that are going on here. I've showed that there's several choices of how to handle that normalization. Okay, one of them is to do it as I've done. Another one is to have that normalization be part of this. So every path has the same normalization, but it's not so simple as this. The justification for it is that when this path integral is integrating something of this kind, I sort of know a priori I'm going to wind up with some finite number. That normalization has to appear in order to give me something finite. Now, yes, indeed, it does go crazy. But on the other hand, whenever you define something like an integral, okay, you always wind up with an integral is just a sum, except the terms in the sum are normalized by the interval of the independent variable. And those guys all go to zero, but the sum doesn't go to zero. So in the same way, even though that normalization factor goes to infinity, the normalization factor times the integrals, all those integrals, of a function of this form, that still remains finite. Okay? So if you just consider the normalization factor in isolation, yes, it goes infinite. Although, in a minute, we'll see an example where something very much like that appears in a non-problematic way. So, yeah?
Well, if I want to do some kind of numerical approximation, if I have a very strange potential, uh-huh. then what do I have to do? Do I have to find the classical trajectories and then the perturbations?
Right. you can... and people do use this as a numerical procedure, but there are difficulties, and the difficulties have to do with the extremely large number of paths. Okay, right? And And so, in order to do that calculation, you'll have to discretize space and discretize time. And to make that calculation, and of course, the number of paths that you have to compute is exponential in the number of time intervals. Okay? You either have to have a fairly crude discrete approximation of what you're doing, or you have to calculate a really stupendously large number of paths, the contribution of a stupendously large number. You might find a way to prune that sum a little bit using this insight, so that if the action is really far from the classical action, then you don't worry so much about the adding them all up, because you know they're all going to about cancel out. But this is not a good candidate for a numerical procedure unless you really don't have anything else you can do. Yeah.
Because once you do somewhere that in the WKB approximation, there's
oh yeah, you can get a WKB approximation out of this. You can get all kinds of, in fact, you can get everything out of this. This is an alternate way of doing quantum mechanics. You know, you can get everything that you get in ordinary quantum mechanics out of this. Once you get the WKB approximation, then basically you don't you're no longer adding up over all possible paths. You have some particular paths in mind that will give you the main behavior of the thing. Let me give you an example of that, okay? Unless there's another vital question that I have to answer in the next minute, I want to give you an example so you can actually see. I mean, have I calculated anything? Have I calculated a propagator? No. And in general, actually, it's harder to calculate things this way. Calculationally, the path integral method is harder. Almost always, the hard way to solve the problem. But often, the easy way to phrase a theory. So that's the important thing. You know, this is, you can't beat that. That's really good. Yeah.
How do we actually understand that symbol dx? Like,
yeah, this script dd, it says that this is a kind of a this is an integral not over a variable. This is an integral over a whole space of functions. This is like integrating over the space of trajectories. Integrating over the space of trajectories, and sort of to remind myself that this is no ordinary integral, I've made this fancy d to say this is an integral over all the functions like this. Okay? Wow, that's a big space. And to really make this rigorous, I'm going to have to talk about measures on such a space. You can do this. Okay? You can do this. You can have measures on function spaces. And it's deep. I can recommend, I think it's chapter 4 from the great mathematical physics textbook by Cecile DeWitt Moret and somebody else. Fantastic treatment of this. But here, this is just shorthand for the limiting case of this discrete multiple integral. Yep, absolutely. And maybe get something that you can then take a limit of. But the only way to calculate an integral, to really calculate an integral, I mean, we have some fundamental theorem of calculus that lets us relate integrals to antiderivatives in nice cases. But the real sum is always a limit of discrete sums. And I might be able to work out some general things, like for Gaussian actions or something. I might be able to figure out how this works. Let me just very quickly work out the propagator for the case of a free particle. And here, I'm going to do it by cheating. I think that the cheating will give me a result that it will be correct, and it'll be right. The cheating is not. The cheating is not in doing something mathematically bad. The cheating is in not doing this exactly. but it will sort of illustrate some of what's going on here. So for a free particle, the Hamiltonian is just p squared over 2 times the mass. And so my propagator is e to the minus I p squared t over 2 mu h bar x initial. Now, instead of dividing this into time intervals, since the Hamiltonian is only a function of momentum, I can put one momentum integral into this, right? I can just do that trick that we did to do the to figure out the thing for the little time interval. I can just do it once for this guy. So this is equal to the integral of dp, and I'll write it as script p to try to slightly typographically distinguish it from the operator p of xf. Script p, e to the minus I p squared t over 2 mu h bar xi, which is equal to the integral over script p of xf script p xi e to the minus I script p squared t over 2 mu h bar, because this is an operator for which this is an eigenvalue, with and I have that that is the what I get from the eigenvalue. This of course just gives me 1 over 2 pi h bar times e to the I script p times xk plus 1 minus xk over h bar, xf minus xi over h bar, just as we had before. And then the whole thing's going to be Gaussian, right? The whole thing's going to be Gaussian. I'm going to be integrating over p of the exponential of minus I p squared t over 2 mu h bar plus I times p times xf minus xi over h bar. And that's a Gaussian integral of my favorite form. So I can just write down the answer to this. And I get that the propagator going from x initial at time 0 to x final at time t is equal to mu over 2 pi h bar I times t to the 1/2 times the exponential of I times mu xf minus x initial squared divided by 2t h bar. That's it. That's the propagator. And that's kind of neat, because if you recognize what's inside here, let's suppose I'm a free particle, and I start out at x initial, and I wind up at x final, okay? Start out at x initial, and I wind up at x final. Okay, classically, I go in a straight line, right? Classically, I go at a uniform speed, okay? So classically, what's my velocity during this time interval? What's my classical velocity? Well, it's going to be the distance I travel. It's going to be xf minus xi divided by the time interval, t. And so what's the Lagrange, what's the action? The action is the integral of the kinetic energy over time, because there's no potential, right? And so the action, the classical action of such a system is, well, let's see, it's 1/2, it's mu over 2 times the classical velocity, classical squared, times t, because you're integrating it over time, right? But that's just equal to mu times xf minus x initial squared divided by 2 times t, because I divide by t squared and I multiply by t. But now I can see that this is exactly some factor times the exponential of I times the classical action of the classical path divided by h bar. Okay? This factor here doesn't depend on where I started and where I ended. It's just a normalization factor which plays the role of taking the propagator and making sure it's the matrix element of a unitary time evolution. Okay? There's going to be some overall normalization to make sure that this guy doesn't affect the normalization of a wave function. And this is the factor that does it. But the factor that does it, does the business, the factor that depends on where you start and where you stop, that is, for a free particle, simply the exponential of I times the classical action over h bar, the classical action for a classical trajectory going from here to here. So that's kind of neat. It means that the ones that go off to the side, all they really do is they take care of this factor. Yeah?
Modulus squared, you pay a priority of...
I'm sorry, if you take the...
The modulus of this k, then it will be a priority of going from xf from xi to xf the time t.
If I take the modulus squared, it will be the probability to go from x initial to x final times the probability of going x final to x initial.
Going from xi to xf at time t.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what it would be. That's exactly what this would be. It would be but actually a probability density. Because since this is a continuous basis, then I have to integrate to get a probability rather than sum.
Okay.
So it's a probability density. So it's a number that might be big, might be 1, bigger than 1, but it can only be bigger than 1 over a very small interval. So when you integrate it, it and integrates to 1. Yeah. So if I were to take this guy, magnitude squared, the exponential, yeah, better yet, if I were to take, so you're saying that this phase would go away in that magnitude. Well, okay, you have to be careful. You have to be careful. What you actually have is a delta function normalization. Okay? So let's do it this way. Let's multiply this by some wave function at xi. Okay? That is normalized. Okay? Then if I integrate over xi. You integrate over xi first, times some wave function. So if I looked at something like this, the integral over dxi of k, and to be a little bit more compact here, psi of xi, okay? If I took this and did that and integrated that over dxf, that should give me 1. If this is 1, right? That should give me 1. The amplitude, the normalization of the amplitudes is a little funny. So you can always resort to putting in a normalized state and requiring that be 1. And then you see that it's not quite so simple that this factor goes away, because this factor is integrated over. That's what so you get a Gaussian integral which you can work out, and it works out fine. Okay, the one remark I want to make is that there are lots of examples, there are lots of situations where the propagator will be something times the propagator of a classical path. Of a classical path. This happens sufficiently often that you should be on the lookout for it. Okay, and the other thing I want to mention is that the number of cases in which you can exactly write down the propagator is small. Just like the number of cases where you can actually find the bound states of a potential, number of potentials, is small. And basically, if you can do the free particle like this, and you can do the harmonic oscillator, which is much harder, and you actually have to work to get that, then you've done a fair fraction of the ones we know how to do.
So you are considering you consider the initial and the final position and the uniform momentum space throughout the whole path. So I don't really see why it's actually different from the classical case.
Okay, so think what this means. It says, I have some initial state. This guy right here is, roughly speaking, the amplitude for starting at this initial state and winding up with this momentum. Okay? That's what this amplitude gives me. Starting at time equal to 0, being in this location, and at time equal to t, having this momentum. But I'm interested not in winding up with this momentum. I'm interested in winding up with a particular position. So I have to multiply by the amplitude for going from that momentum, a state of that momentum, to a state of that position at that time, and integrate over all these momenta, because I'm never measuring this momentum. So you can think of this as being position at time equal to 0, time evolution, momentum at time equal to t, to position at time equal t, having to add over these intermediate values of momentum, because that's never measured actually. So does that help you understand what this is meaning?
Yeah, I actually understand it. I'm looking at how the classical path, that is very much
different. Oh, I see. Right. So how do you get the action for the classical action here? Is that for the action for just the classical path here? Is that what you're asking?
No, that case and the classical case, to me, it looks like the same thing, because I'm not seeing how interference will come in.
Okay, so you're talking about the classical case. I'm not sure what you mean about talking about this in the classical case, because this is the quantum mechanics.
You have explained the classical case here, which okay, yeah. Just considering that the classical.
I'm thinking classically here. There's no quantum mechanics.
Okay.
There's just an action principle.
In the classical case, you are considering that the particle would take the classical path.
Yes, this is the delta s equals 0 path.
I want to actually see how this doesn't boil down to the same path. How this case doesn't boil down to the same path when we are just considering.
Oh, I see. Well, of course, I see. Although I have not actually done the path integral for this, I've gotten to it a little bit more directly, just because it's an easier calculation. That's all I have time for. Even though I've done it this way, this is equal to a path integral where we where we add up the actions for all the paths going from the initial to the final. It just happens that in the special case of a free particle, the net result of adding up for all the paths, including extremely non-classical paths that differ very radically from the straight line path, the net result of adding up all those guys happens to be a factor times, a factor that depends on time, by the way, times the exponential of I times the action of the classical path. That's a. I don't want to give a too much of a significance to that. It just happens that this is very easy in this case. But this is only going to be the case for the free particle, where the Hamiltonian has a very special form, where the action has a very special form. Yeah.
Could we see this from a symmetry argument? Say we don't have a potential which makes any point in space more special than other. So the straight line, all the paths which are symmetrical around the straight line, should actually kind of somehow conspire to.
I see.
Just give us.
That's a nice bit of argument, and you can argue, for example, that right away that the action can only depend on the difference between the initial and the final guys. But if, for example, the action didn't depend on x dot squared, but x dot to the fourth, if you had some little weird
right.
kind of connection, it wouldn't be the same. Okay, so I think it does depend on the fact that this is quadratic in the difference between x and initial and x dot. We're going to have to turn it off in about 1 minute. So what I'll find out if I can answer your question.
And so is that path integral formula true in general? That path integral formula,
this?
The general one, is that true in general for all potentials or all kinds of particles?
Yeah. And indeed, I talked about particles moving in one dimension. In fact, you might say that this is how you would actually define the quantum dynamics in more general cases. Okay, this is where you start. Okay, and other things that you derive would be secondary. This is a place to begin writing down the quantum mechanical theory of a system. If you have an action to work from, then you can write down an action for a corresponding classical system. You can begin by calculating a path integral for the system. That's how you start to do the quantum mechanics.
Some people might argue that the path integral in the phase space is actually more.
That's right. We're taking quadratic. Yeah, that's right. We have to get to the Lagrangian. We did assume that our Hamiltonian was quadratic in the momentum. And that allowed us to do everything very neatly. And that's true, for non-relativistic particles, if they function in potentials, or even if they interact with electromagnetic fields, because that just introduces terms of order P and P squared maybe in your calculation. Yeah, and then I'm really going to have to cut it.
Before we perform the Gaussian integral, we had a form where you had P x dot minus the Hamiltonian, and that's the Lagrangian.
Exactly, but it's the Lagrangian, that's a function not of x and x dot, but of t x and x dot. It's a functional of the path in phase space. It's numerically equal to the Lagrangian, and that's great, but it's not the Lagrangian in the sense that it's not a functional of a configuration space path, it's a functional of a phase space path, and we have to integrate over all the phase space paths. So it's not quite the same, but numerically that is the same. It's the same thing. Okay, that's it. We'll see you Monday. We'll do something completely different on Monday.
Yeah.